Today on Maine Calling, caring for your pets. Summer is upon us, and in these warmer months, the family pets have more opportunities to go outside, are exposed to the elements, time spent in hot cars, ticks and fleas, and to things they should not be eating. I'm Keith Shortall, and today on the program, we'll talk with a panel of veterinarians about the risks that cats and dogs face in the summer, and what you can do to protect them. We'll explore what food is best to give your pets, how to keep them free from parasites, and to get the right treatment for certain health conditions. We'll also discuss how to prepare for the loss of a beloved pet. And as always, we'll take your questions. Keeping your pets happy and healthy. Maine Calling is coming up. First, this news.
Maine Calling is made possible in part by Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville, and by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Down East communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. The warmer weather is here, and with it, ticks and other outdoor hazards. Today, I have a panel of veterinarians with me to answer your pet care questions, and we'll also spend some time discussing the difficult issues that arise at the end of a beloved pet's life. My guests are Dr. Jesse Tarrion, staff veterinarian at Animal Welfare Society Community Veterinary Clinic, and owner of At Peace Vet Home Euthanasia, Dr. Una Wack, veterinarian at Falmouth Veterinary Hospital, and Dr. Ezra Steinberg, veterinary surgeon at Maine Veterinary Medical Center in Scarborough. We invite you to join the conversation. What questions or concerns do you have about your furry, scaled, or winged friends? Email talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call, the number 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. I want to begin with a difficult story that was in the news recently, but is timely for the discussion of the summer months and dogs in cars specifically. Last week, a state comfort dog, a 3-year-old chocolate lab named Baxter, died in a car on a warm day without air conditioning. And maybe we could use this to broach this subject. And I'll start with Dr. Una Wack. As a veterinarian, how would you guide the general public about the do's and don'ts of leaving dogs in cars during the summer months?
Yeah, that's a really relevant question for our recent hot weather. Certainly, when you've been in a car and you get back in your car, it's so hot, even if it's only 60 degrees outside. So just being aware that temperature inside a closed vehicle can really get high quickly. And also, certain breeds of dogs, like our short-faced friends, like bulldogs and Frenchies, are even more sensitive to this hot weather. So kind of just maybe don't take your pet in the car or leave the air conditioning running with a sign, "My air conditioning is running," so you don't get your car window broken. And just really think about, do you need to take your pet in the car during hot weather if you're going to be leaving them for any length of time?
I've seen guidelines such as no more than 5 minutes, and only if the temperature is above freezing and below 70. Do you recommend like having parameters, or do you think simplifying it and being conservative is the better way?
Yeah, I think being conservative makes sense. You know, I've seen a little Frenchie get into trouble when it was only 60 degrees and the windows were open. So I think just being extra cautious, it would just feel terrible if that happened.
And just explain, if you would, a little bit about why dogs are more susceptible to heat stroke than we are. Is it the mechanism by which they cool down?
So dogs, unlike us, can't sweat. So they eliminate their heat either through panting or through their foot pads. And in a hot car, you know, that gets overwhelmed pretty quickly.
Yeah. Any other thoughts from anyone else on the panel before we move on to my favorite subject of fleas?
And that story was horrific because like they left the car running with the AC on and the car turned off. And I know that some of these new cars have like, or, you know, and they have no explanation for why the car shut off as far as I heard. But some of these new cars, Teslas and Rivians and stuff, they have these like dog modes where it says like there's a dog in the car on the dash and then it keeps it at a certain temperature and you'd think that would be safe, but it made me think twice about should that feature become available in most cars, unless it alerts you that your car turns off. That's really, really scary. And yeah, I saw some figure. It was like, if it's 70 degrees outside within 20 minutes, your car will be 100 degrees inside. And most people wouldn't think that.
It gets hot really
heat up
fast.
That quickly.
I would just add also, that, I mean, it's, even though our pets may be more susceptible, people are just as susceptible as to heat stroke too. And so just use common sense. If you wouldn't leave your kids in the car because it's a certain temperature outside, then you probably don't want to leave your pets in the car either.
Yeah, that's a good point. So on now to, because it is that time and well past that time, but fleas in the warmer months here, we kind of sort of forget about them. I do anyway, probably shouldn't in the winter time. But with the return of what we generally think of as flea and tick season, is it safe to assume that if you have a dog that goes outside or a cat that goes outside in that they probably have fleas, or should you really just sort of comb through and look for eggs, or what advice would you give Dr. Terry?
I guess I wouldn't assume that your dog has fleas, but I would assume that if your dog is going to be spending time outside, they're going to be very susceptible to getting fleas. And so using flea and tick products, you know, especially during the summer months, but there are some reasons why you would want to use them all year round, is always recommended. And so, you know, I think people don't like fleas because they don't like to think about them getting on themselves, but there are other reasons to use flea and tick products. There are, they cover a wide host of use for like mites and different parasites, including intestinal parasites. And so it's not, those flea and tick products aren't just for the things that are creepy, crawly, and gross us out. They, you know, they help with lots of other things that pets can get.
Is it safe to say that if one of your pets has fleas, that the other ones also have fleas, even without inspection?
I guess, again, I wouldn't assume, but yeah, if you find fleas on one of your pets, then they're probably going to be pretty ubiquitous and they're very hard to get rid of. And so preventing them is really the best thing to do.
Right. Easier because of they have this sort of life cycle that makes it hard to stop them from reproducing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Dr. Wack?
We tend not to see as much flea pressure this time of year. It tends to be later in the summer, but we are seeing tons of ticks. And Ezra and Jesse probably have also experienced this. I think I've had more ticks on me this year than ever before, that they just hitchhike in on my pets. And so, you know, ticks have been pretty, pretty crazy.
Having, I've had several cases of Lyme and got anaplasmosis, and all of it not from hiking in the backyard, but from a cat who likes to walk in the tall grass and has brought them in, and I find them on him all the time. So we're doing the treatment. Is there a preferred tick treatment? Do any of you have a recommendation for a specific regimen that's safe and effective?
For dogs, you know, the oral preventatives really seem to be the most effective. And for cats, there's a topical called Revolution that works pretty well. But we are also in high tick pressure areas recommending an addition of a flea and tick collar to help prevent attachment, to be an extra layer of protection. And some dogs also can wear a permethrin impregnated vest when they're out in the tall grass. So it may again be just an extra layer of protection against the ticks.
So they may, so the collar helps to keep the tick from becoming embedded. So they might be on the animal, but will not want to get under the skin.
Correct. It like paralyzes the jaws of the tick, so they won't attach or be less likely to attach.
And would you say that this is a year-round thing, or should, I mean, can we start thinking about it in the in March, or do we have to really think about this all year round? I know ticks are easily survive weather extremes and are active late and early in the season.
That's certainly true. You know, with our ticks, we see them every month of the year and are picking them off every month of the year. So we do recommend year-round tick prevention. We certainly see spikes, though, in the, you know, spring and fall seems to be our sort of heavier infestations. But it's the little nymphs that we are having a harder time finding, and those are the ones that occur earlier in the season. And those ones can also transmit diseases. So preventing that early infection is really important.
And dogs and cats are more than just vector helpers here, transporting the ticks inside. They are both susceptible to the vector-borne diseases, the tick-borne diseases. I think I know a friend. I have a friend who has a dog who's being treated for anaplasmosis. Are both dogs and cats susceptible? Anyone in the panel?
Yeah, go ahead.
They actually are, but we see it much more common in dogs. I mean, maybe it's because our subset of population of cats are indoor, but it is rare. It's a bit of a left field diagnosis if you're looking for it in a cat, but dogs, it is like extremely prevalent. And people that use prevention year round, we are still seeing them come up positive for tick-borne diseases. We're seeing in this area, I've seen a fair amount in the past couple of years of Rocky Mountain spotted fever testing positive, which did not used to be in this area many years ago. So it's, I mean, prevention's great. And like Dr. Wax said, the doubling them up with the oral and the collar is like 100% my recommendation if they're going to be out playing.
Yeah. Dr. Terry,
you know, also with these regulations of the towns and not being able to spray pesticides anymore and, you know, having to go all organic, which I'm not saying is a bad thing, but it is making it really, really hard to control the environment.
Yeah. Dr. Terry, did you want to add something?
I was just going to basically agree too with, I think we don't see it as much in cats just because most of the cats that we see are indoor pets. But we also don't test cats as frequently for tick-borne diseases. So that could be another reason why we're not seeing them as frequently. But then I agree with everything that the other veterinarians have said as far as preventatives. But I think most important, too, is the preventative that's going to work is the one that people are going to use. So if you can make sure that you're using something, whatever you choose to use is going to be more effective than not using anything at all.
And so I was, you know, people who've had these diseases can become quite ill. I was really sick. I was going to say sick as a dog. That's not appropriate for this program. But do the animals present with signs of illness? I mean, are they really made ill by these diseases?
So the difference, well, Lyme is probably the one that we see most commonly causing clinical signs. And in dogs, and I think this has come up in this show before, but in dogs, a minority of patients that test positive will have clinical signs. So a lot of dogs are going to have Lyme disease. They're going to test positive for Lyme disease, but a fraction of them are actually going to have clinical signs. Now, these clinical signs can be really, really severe and really scary. But contrary to in people, if you get Lyme disease, you're probably going to be sick from it.
Yeah. Dr. Wack?
I think, too, you know, we're seeing a lot of anaplasma cases, as you were infected with, Keith. And, you know, the vast majority of those dogs aren't clinically ill, but some of those signs can be fairly subtle, you know, just like lack of appetite, you know, a low-grade fever that you wouldn't necessarily appreciate, but usually people see that their pets are off in some way. And a positive test is not enough alone to diagnose the disease. Usually you'll want to have a CBC done to check for platelets and white blood cell counts that can be pathognomonic for that disease.
It's all so just another seasonal issue here is I've been reading up in some of the trade, some of your professional trade magazines about this, the stories for the spring. And one of them was about the about kitten season, it being kitten season. And that there's always this surge of kittens in shelters, which can overwhelm the shelters. Do we see that in Maine, or are there these sort of ebbs and flows of animals coming into the system? And does that affect you? Do you see a, like a sudden need to care for a lot of kittens in the spring? I'm just curious about that. Dr. Wack?
Oh, I'm looking at Jesse. She's going to be the one who can just answer that.
I thought maybe you guys would default to me on that one. So I will. Yeah. yeah. I mean, I'll admit I'm new at the shelter. And so I was practicing emergency veterinarian for 13 years. So this is a little bit new for me. But certainly, and, you know, being a shelter that we are, we get kittens all year long, but that's not always necessarily because the kittens are born in Maine. We, you know, we get animals from the South very frequently as well. But certainly spring is known to be kitten season. And that's when a lot of outdoor feral cats tend to give birth. But as far as my aspect at the shelter, I think from what I've seen so far, it always seems to be kitten season.
All the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we want to hear from you. The number again is 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today, we're getting answers to your questions about pet care. With me, Dr. Ezra Steinberg with Maine Veterinary Medical Center in Scarborough, Dr. Una Wack with Falmouth Veterinary Hospital, and Dr. Jesse Tarian with Animal Welfare Society's Community Veterinary Clinic. Share your comments and questions, email talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call, the number 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. I want to go to pet food. We see a lot of commercials on television advertising these sort of new, either gourmet or, you know, claiming to be super nutritious cat and dog foods, and trying to leverage our owner guilt to buy some of these foods. And I'm wondering if you could just give general guidance. I will ask each of you. Maybe I'll start with Dr. Tarian, if you have thoughts about how do we weed through all of these promises and the notion that that our pets need, you know, this really high end food as opposed to what we might you know, get at the grocery store or at our veterinarians.
I mean, I certainly can understand, and I get a lot, especially because we really service the low-income community. I get a lot of questions about diet, and similarly to what you just said about pet parents feeling guilty for not being able to afford, you know, the higher-end brands. And I don't always think that the higher-end brands are more nutritious in any way. However, you know, just like with the food that we eat, the more processed a food is, the less healthy it's probably going to be. And so if you're able to get, you know, something that's more of a whole food or a whole food diet or a fresh food diet, I think just like what we feed ourselves that's going to be healthier. And that could even mean potentially cooking for your pet if that's a way to save some money. I don't think that's always an option for most people. But I think as long as you're able to feed a pet food that's balanced, that's really going to be the most important thing. And us as veterinarians, we're not going to know everything about every single pet food brand. And so, you know, don't expect us to be an expert on all the foods that come on the market. And then there's obviously a lot of questions around raw food and raw food diets. And I'm not personally 100% against raw food, but I think it really is important on where you source that food from and how it's handled. And there's, you know, I would say there's a lot of warnings about, you know, where you're getting your food in from and how quickly it can become contaminated. And so you'd have to be really careful if you're considering something like that.
Dr. Wack?
Yeah. So as far as, you know, expensive pet foods, I think Jesse is exactly right that they're not necessarily always the best foods. One of the things that we're still noticing, in 2018, the FDA had come out with a grain-free pet food concerns, and that really more involved pet foods that were high in legumes, so like lentils, garbanzos, peas, that type of thing. And that was associated with the higher incidence of heart disease in dogs. And we're still seeing those diets out there all the time, and it's sort of fallen off the radar as far as people's awareness. So educating people on how to read a pet food label, that if your pet food has any of those legumes as the first five ingredients, which means that it's in a higher proportion for that diet, that may not be the safest food for your pet.
Yeah. And Dr. Steinberg, any thoughts?
Yeah. So as a surgeon, I would say that the main times I'm going to get interested in food for my patients, well, so the number one is that the dog is overweight. Or the cat is overweight. And it's really difficult to say. Everybody comes in and says, well, how much should I be feeding them? And it's really tough. Like, I would say that just like people, you could eat the same amount of calories and some people gain weight, some people will just waste away. Same thing with dogs. So I usually, when they say that they have been feeding what's on the back of the dog food, I would say, well, you know, you can run with that for a little while and weigh your pet regularly. Most veterinary clinics have a scale up in the front, and I don't think any vets are going to mind if people come in and just weigh their animal regularly. And I encourage people to like write it down, keep a log of it. And I say feed about 20% less. Like you don't always have to buy diet food. You just feed less food. A lot of my patients come in and they're like, well, we haven't been able to exercise because they're pre-knee surgery or post-op knee surgery. And you have to take that into account and really decrease the amount of calories taken in when you are not able to be as active. The other thing with pet food is that I deal with a lot of prescription diets more so than just regular brands, because a lot of times these new prescription diets allow us to give less medications, which I think is always great. So there's a fair amount of prescription joint diets that allow you to dose reduce, say like a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, which will be safer on the pet. But as always, I mean, check with your vet. If you are cooking for your own pet, there's great resources. You can talk to your vet, or there's a website called Balance It, which will just make sure that you're not missing any key ingredients that could cause some nutritional deficiencies.
And no fatty meats. I know that there are issues of dogs being fed table scraps of fatty meat, and it's bad news.
We like to avoid it, but I also have to be realistic and know that it fills people's hearts to give their dog a treat every now and then.
All right, let's go to the phones now. We have some calls coming in. We'll go to Thomaston and Kristen. Are you there, Kristen?
Yes, hello. Thank you. I have a follow-up question to the anaplasmosis question. My dog is coincidentally being treated for anaplasmosis as well. And I was just curious if there are any long-term sequelae, even if the dog does the full treatment, to that particular tick-borne disease.
So interestingly, with anaplasma, dogs seem to be able to clear it from their system faster and more effectively than Lyme disease. So usually with the antibiotic treatment, we don't see relapses, you certainly could get reinfections. So that's a cause for concern and continued prevention. But your dog should do well after his treatment.
And did you have another question, Krista?
No, I don't think so. Is she going to be any more likely? I mean, I cannot keep this dog out of the woods. She's a German short hair pointer. And as long as we do the preventatives, is she any more likely to reinfect, or is just luck of the draw?
You know, even on preventatives, they still can get reinfected, even if we're very diligent about giving them. But we talked about adding a second layer of protection, either a collar or maybe one of those permethrin vests, which might be a good idea for your dog.
All right, Kristen, thank you. Full disclosure, Kristen is a friend. Kristen, say hi to Dan for me. Let's go to, let's see if we can, let's see if I can end the call. There we go. And let's go to Gail in Portland. Hi, Gail, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, thanks for taking my call and for having this program today. I have a family member who just recently lost a beloved pet to an accident, like a street accident. And she's having a really hard time with this emotionally. And I wonder if any of you have recommendations for, you know, support groups or, you know, folks that she can talk with who are, so she knows she's not alone in this.
Yeah, Jesse, I know this is your realm. So we'll let you
Yeah. I wish I had been prepared for this in advance. I know the crematorium that I use, which is Final Gift, they have a support line or a grief hotline. But I also know that the shelter has shared some resources with me, and I can try. I don't know if you guys have notes that you could put up afterwards, but I could certainly try to get some of those websites to you, because there are definitely some really good grief support lines for pet parents. But I unfortunately just can't think of them off the top of my head.
Yeah.
But I'm very sorry for your friend's loss. That sounds horrible.
Yeah, Gail, I am sorry. We also, at MVMC, we do have a pet loss support group, and we're dealing with a lot of tragedy over there, unfortunately. So we have a virtual monthly pet loss support group. We can put the link, I guess, on the website or Facebook page after this. And there's
I was just going to say, we can post it. We can also post
great,
it on our
great.
Website and
so,
on social media.
Yeah, and that loss doesn't have to happen at MVMC in order to join in on these groups. And I would encourage a lot of people to try to show up, even if you don't have anything to say and you just want to listen to other people. It can be really helpful.
And a little later, I want to take up the end of life discussion, and we'll talk more in detail about some of the options there. But I want to see if we can work in a few more questions here in the segment. Gail, thank you for calling. Let's go to Richard now in Westbrook. Hi, Richard. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. Welcome. I have a quick question. I'm curious what they might recommend with Frontline or Provecto for, you know, tick and flea treatment. Is there benefits of, you know, one over the other, or what your thoughts are on that?
So Frontline is a topical medication that's been around for quite a long time. And it certainly can be used for tick prevention, and it's certainly maybe one of the safest ones available. We are finding, though, that towards the end of the month, by like week three or so, we are getting attached and engorged ticks. So, you know, they're maybe overlapping your therapy, that giving it more often might be needed. The Bravecto certainly is a more effective medication, but the ticks do have to bite them to get the medication. And in certain groups of dogs, like dogs who are prone to neurologic disorders or seizures, that may not be a medication that we would recommend.
All right, Richard, thank you. Good luck. Email from Myra, who says, I have adopted a 1-plus-year-old cat who loved to walk outside and loves to eat grass. He is protected with Bravecto, but is he still at risk for particular diseases from grass or soil? Yeah, Dr. Steinberg.
Myra, this is something that I was going to bring up if there was free time about eating grass. And in terms of eating grass, ingesting things that are outside, you know, most of the issues come from eating other animals' poop and getting GI parasites. So you, definitely if you have another animal, you want to clean up after them and dispose of it properly. But something that I see pretty commonly in the summertime is are foreign bodies. From grass, dogs are out there and they are just in the long grass. My dog, I think maybe because she's still hungry, which she is all the time, just sits there and eats grass. And we come in, dogs are vomiting, and we diagnose them with a foreign body obstruction, and we go take them to surgery and we cut out just this like wad of grass that's all braided together. And why dogs eat grass, that's a whole nother conversation. People say it's because they're nauseous. Sometimes we think they just eat it because they're hungry and then it makes them nauseous. But I always tell people if they see their dog eating grass, get them to stop. Same thing like with dirt, or we've had a fair amount of like sand and dirt impactions. So dogs that are on the beach chasing a tennis ball, every time they pick up the tennis ball, they get a little bit of sand in their mouth and they swallow it, and it just can totally impact their bowel. So if your dog or cat, that's an interesting one, is outside eating anything, I mean, nothing in excess should be allowed.
Email from Frank. Is it okay to give leftover animal bones from steaks, marrow bones, etc. to adult dogs? If so, which are safest, best? Yeah, Dr. Wagner.
I really don't recommend animal bones or antlers. We do a lot of dentals in our practice, and we extract a lot of fractured teeth from bones. And as well, the marrow of the bones is very high in fat and becomes rancid really pretty quickly. And so we see cases of pancreatitis and gastrointestinal upset with marrow bones. So I think they should be off the menu altogether.
I want to turn to vaccinations. I think I was reading in one of your trade magazines about, you know, obviously vets urge their pet owners to get vaccinations. And among those who don't, some of the clients who don't, it's either they say they can't afford it, or because they distrust vaccines, which is this phenomenon that we've seen on the human side since the pandemic. And I'm wondering if in your practices you come across this when you urge a pet owner to get a vaccination done. Are you seeing resistance because of the distrust issue?
I think that we are. You know, certainly people are asking more questions about, does my pet really need this vaccine? And just having that conversation with your veterinarian about, you know, risks and benefits is certainly a good thing to do. I think, though, if you have the opportunity to educate them about, you know, the rabies that we see in the wildlife population and the leptospirosis that can cause your dogs to have kidney or liver failure, hopefully that they will understand that there's significant benefit to giving those vaccines, and, you know, their veterinarian's recommendations should be followed.
Yeah. We're going to take another quick break here to join the conversation again. The number is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Our topic today, the latest news from the world of veterinary medicine and advice for addressing summer health concerns. My guests are Una Wack, veterinarian at Falmouth Veterinary Hospital, Ezra Steinberg, veterinary surgeon at Maine Veterinary Medical Center, and Jesse Tarian, staff veterinarian at Animal Welfare Society Community Veterinary Clinic and owner of At Peace Vet Home Euthanasia. We invite you to join the conversation. The number is 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mainpublic.org, or you can post a comment on Facebook or on Instagram. Let's go to Holly in Auburn. Hi, Holly. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Hear me?
Yes, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a 5-year-old male cat, and in the last couple of years, he has started to vomit quite regularly after he eats. I took him to the vet, and the vet said, I'm looking at a healthy cat, didn't do any testing, and said maybe he's allergic to the food. And he continues to vomit pretty regularly every other day or so. Should I get a workup, get him, you know, a full-time, full workup to see if there's something else going on?
Well, I'm just going to just up front say, you know, all the doctors here, I'm sure, would say we can't really tell unless we examine your pet and know about the case. So this is not medical advice you're about to give, but just to educate people in the spirit of the program. Who would like to take that? Dr. Steinberg, go ahead.
It is so hard to say. So that seems like a pretty frequent amount of vomiting. Other things to factor in is like, is there any weight loss? Does the cat just eat too quickly and brings it back up? But there are a lot of underlying causes of IBD. 5 years old is the right age. It's probably unlikely that it's anything too concerning, although we'd never really know. But yeah, I mean, I would just talk to your vet again. And some things that we think about are just checking blood work, sometimes either doing an abdominal ultrasound at your hospital or referring them out. And then like the advanced diagnostics would sometimes be GI biopsies. But there is an amazingly variable range of treatment options. And some people just want to start off with like a different food. But I would just call your vet again and just say, this is still going on. And is there anything else that we could try?
Yeah. Dr. Wack, did you want to add something?
Yeah. The vomiting pretty soon after eating is sort of our classic scarf and barf that we see with a lot of our kitty friends. One thing to consider trying is you can get slow feeders for cats as well, like little puzzle feeders, or feeding them on a cookie tray just so they can't take big mouthfuls of food all at once. But to Ezra's point, like if there's weight loss or anything like that, you know, a workup is certainly a good idea.
So the feeders are these, they're bowls, but they have like little mountain ranges in them that may even force you to use your tongue to get the food out of the little crevasses, and that slows them down. That's how it works, right? Yeah. I wanted to, before, I don't want to run out of time here. We've got so much to talk about and so many folks trying to call, but I do want to go back to this, you know, idea of planning for the time when it's the end of your pet's life. And, you know, I grew up in the era where, we buried our pet in the backyard and we, you know, put a cross on it and that was that. But now I think as we think more of our pets as members of the family, there are more choices to make here and more options as we get ready for that horrible day. And let's just start, Jesse Therrien, with you, because this is something that you do, a service you offer in terms of home euthanasia. But let's talk about making the decision, first of all. So you've got a very ill pet. Do you offer guidance on medical guidance on how to make that decision?
Yeah. So, I mean, I try. It becomes a little bit tricky just specifically with what I do as far as my home business, just because I'm not typically the pet's primary veterinarian. And so I'm only getting so much of the story from the pet owner. And sometimes it can be very in-depth, and sometimes it's just, it's time and they're old and whatever the case may be. And so, you know, I try to offer some sort of general guidance, and there are websites too. The one that I usually recommend to people is through the Ohio State Veterinary school. They have a quality of life scale. And so if you just type in Ohio State quality of life, you'll get this sort of checklist that kind of helps guide you through the things at the end of your pet's life that are sort of overall affecting their quality of life, and it will give you an actual number. And it really, I think that can be really helpful to people that maybe don't have that black and white answer as far as like a fatal diagnosis or something else that's very clear cut. And so I try to offer as much guidance as I can, but I usually try to defer back to their primary veterinarian if there's specific questions that they have about their pet's health. But I also always feel like once a person has made that decision, I'm just here to help support them. And I always tell people that they're making the most loving decision that they can. And it's a gift that we can give people to offer their pet a good death. And I will be there when they need me.
There was, there were many people who've gone through this. They have that, the bad day comes and they go to the vet and they leave the animal there and that's it. In this case, though, some people want to be there, and so and maybe not in this clinical setting if they don't have to. So talk about what option they would have instead of that.
Yeah, and so that's where the planning part really helps. And so it's not always, if someone's in the ER and they get the really bad news, sometimes they do have a few days to plan. And not everybody wants to have their pet pass at home, but I think the more that people learn about it and the more that people know that it's an option, a lot of people are really embracing it and thinking how much more comfortable their pets can be if they can let them pass at home. But not everybody also wants that memory in their house or in their living room. And so, it's not a you need to do it this way or that way. For me and for my business, for my home business, it usually is helpful for you to be able to plan. And so a few days, if you can, I think most vets that do home euthanasia are willing to see urgent cases if they have the time in their schedule. But it's a really nice way. And I see a lot of cats. I see a lot of cats and dogs, but I think the majority of cats that I meet don't like going to the vet. And so it's a really good option for cats specifically, but for dogs who want to be in their favorite spot in the backyard. Or I've been on boats. I've done euthanasias at the beach. And so it's a really good option as far as, making that last moment exactly how you would like it to be.
And so you're sort of in this moment with these families. It's a very emotional time. It's more than simply being a clinician and administering the drugs. It's sort of like you're part of what's going on in the memories of those families. So it's really an expansion of the traditional, veterinary role.
Yeah. And it's something that I have no training for. So, we don't learn in veterinary school how to be people's therapists or social workers. And so it's something that I feel, very gifted that I'm able to help people in those moments. But I get a lot of pet parents that tell me this must be the hardest job in the world. And really the hardest part is being that person for them. And I try to offer all the emotional support that I can, but as far as the hard part for their pets, I know that they're making the right decision and I'm helping them, with that decision. But yeah, it can be very emotional getting the parents through that.
Dr. Steinberg, do you deal with this, post-surgery for either it's an emergency that the animal can't be saved or the animal's suffering? Can you just talk a little bit about that part of your job?
Yeah, it comes up. I mean, luckily, don't have to do many euthanasias. It is, I count on one hand the amount of euthanasias that I have to do in a several month period. But when it comes into play, sometimes, unfortunately, it is an emergency and we don't have time. And that is just about the worst of it. If we do have a little bit of time, and that OSU resource is some Dr. Tan, I think that's a really great thing. But it's tough. And especially when like one family member is traveling, it always happens that way, that somebody's out of town and they don't have as much time. But I think that the comforting thing is that we have the ability to stay humane in veterinary medicine and not make these patients suffer. And usually people know that it's time if they have to make that decision that day. And even though it is just the most difficult thing you do, there's got to be some element of relief afterwards. But talking to the social worker, I mean, the amount of resources that we have these days and the different options, it is like one of the best things we've done in veterinary medicine, such as like the home euthanasia. I'm doing it by appointment at your veterinarian. There's now a facility. Dr. Rakshanis, who's been on the show before, has a new facility called Farewell, My Friend, that you can actually go there with your pet and they can euthanize the patient there. There's another doc around here that's doing aquamation disposal, which is an alternative to cremation. So we have so many options that will make one of the most difficult processes just a little bit easier. But it's still unthinkable.
Yeah, it's hard too with kids and bringing them along through this. And so I want to bring in Karen, who's calling from Yarmouth. Hi, Karen. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. As I've been listening to you, you've been saying so many of the things that I'm calling about. We've had 4 family dogs and 1 cat put down at the end of their lives. We adopted older dogs, so, you know, it happened a little more frequently than most families. But the first time, we had a dog that was 12 and she had cancer, and the vet had determined that the outcome was going to be pretty much the same regardless. So we kept her comfortable until it was time. And we explained to our sons, who were 7 and 9 at the time, that she was sick, she wasn't going to get better, and the vet would give her medicine to put her to sleep and then to stop her heart. We made sure to have those 2 steps so that they didn't just think about it as going to sleep. But the vet came to our home to do it. And at the time, backing up one step, when I told the boys about it, my younger son said, I want to be there. I want to tell her I love her and not to be afraid. And I said I would check and see if that could happen. Bunches of people advised us against it who had a dog die at home with different natural causes and things, and people who didn't even see a dog die. They all said it would be traumatic. But I talked to my vet, who said, nope, you should do it. It may have helped that he knew my son, but also he said people make it into something in their mind that it isn't, and it's very peaceful and very gentle. My other son had decided not to come, but when I went and picked up my younger one from school and brought him home, the other one said, yes, I do want to come. So all 4 of us were together in the backyard, and we buried her in the backyard afterwards. It was a beautiful, sacred, sad time as a family, but it was such a bonding thing for all of us. And it gave my boys a chance. They wanted to get in the grave because they were 7 and 9-year-old boys. So we let them get in the grave before we put her there to see it's just a hole in the ground. You know, it was a real learning experience. And I think Keith was talking about how we used to just bury our pets in the yard, and, you know, now we're more separated from it. But it was something that, as sad as it was, I wouldn't have missed it for anything. It made such a difference for everybody, for them to be there.
Karen, thank you so much for sharing the story. Yeah. And I'm sure other people who are about to go through this or are going through this may take note of your story. So let's continue on then with, so what happens in terms of the death happens, and instead of burying it in the backyard, there are other options, Dr. Terry. And how would you advise people to weigh those options, and what are they?
So I don't know that I have specific advice for weighing the options. I think that usually most people have an idea of what they'd like to do. Obviously, if you're in a home that you plan to be in for a very long time, and you have a place to bury your pet, and that seems like something you want to do, and you can then visit your pet. But not everybody has that option. And, you know, a lot of people live in apartments, or they're, you know, disabled and they can't do the actual burial part. And so I specifically offer cremation. Like I mentioned before, I use Final Gift. And so that's a flame-based cremation service. And typically that means I'll be taking the pet with me when I leave. And then I handle sort of all the aftercare for you, and then getting the cremains returned to you. But as Dr. Steinberg had mentioned as well, there is a sort of newer water-based cremation, and that's called aquamation. And that's something that's available now. I think there are several locations in Maine. And so that's basically using water instead of flame to get the cremains, but you still end with the same outcome. And so you'd still be able to get your pet's ashes returned to you. And so there are lots of options for anyone that is looking for them.
Well, with that, we're out of time. Really appreciate another hour with all of you. Very interesting and helpful again. So thank you. Dr. Ezra Steinberg is a veterinary surgeon at Maine Veterinary Medical Center. Dr. Una Wack is a veterinarian at Falmouth Veterinary Hospital. And Dr. Jesse Tarian, a staff veterinarian at Animal Welfare Society Community Veterinary Clinic and owner of At Peace Vet Home Euthanasia. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. Our theme music was composed by Mike Jandro. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn, and you can find past shows and sign up for Maine Calling's weekly newsletter by going to the Maine Calling website, mainecalling.org. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.